given some definitions of some terms that we'll get to as we go along. Rationalism and rationality, it's going to be important that we see the difference between these two. We want to reject the one and embrace the other, and so we make sure that we get the right one in the right place. Faith, I've put a dictionary definition because I think this is going to be one of the crucial things. We're going to talk about what it really is and what people think it is. Existentialism, of course, is a current word and a current way of thinking, so I thought it'd be good to put a definition down of that. And then when I noticed that they used the word nihilism and existentialism, I thought I'd better define that. And then these diagrams I'll explain as we go along. The second page may look totally confusing to you, but we'll be referring to the upper story and the lower story, and that's what each of these lines is. This could be one continuous line, but since the paper isn't long enough, we put it in four, and attempted in using different approaches to explain this. So we'll get to this. I had thought I might have to say something about why this is important. Apparently a lot's already been said about that. I certainly thought of this morning as Bob was speaking about the overseas thing, talking about going to Satan's territory overseas. I'm sure we've all heard stories of this, particularly in regard to in the East, even more than Europe, going to Japan and some of these places. And I think you'd feel as I do. You may already feel this way on your campus, on my campus. Many times I feel like I'm in Satan's territory to a great degree just when I go over on campus, particularly these days, and see the things that are going on. And I think we're going to find this to be increasingly so right here in America, because what's happening, what is the case already in the Orient and what is happening in Europe is increasingly happening here. And we wonder why, I think, a lot of times. And I believe that as we look at the history of some of this today, we can see the trends in modern thought, how we're getting to where we are. I don't know if you've found, as I have, that when you have people living in your home or in your ministry that you're working with, often the first time you meet their parents and have dinner with them or something, you're amazed at how much more, when you go away from that situation, you understand this individual you're working with. After you've met their family and seen their background that they've come from and the home that they grew up in, maybe you've gone to their home when you were in their city. Well, I think this is much the same in regard to society. When we understand our own background and the intellectual, the thinking that's preceded what people are thinking now, it'll help us to understand why this is the case and where we're going and so on. Bob talked about learning the language and the thought forms. He talked about the language of the heart. And one of the things we're faced with today is communicating the gospel to people and getting the thought form, not just saying words, which may have completely different meaning to us than they do to them, but communicating in terms of thought forms. And so we're faced today with something we've never been faced with before in America. We always have been overseas. And that is not only learning the language and the thought forms, learning a new religion, learning a new culture, and more and more, the campus and a lot of the elements on the campus are a foreign culture, and they're embracing foreign religions. I don't know if you have faced, I'm sure most of you have run into this on your campus, that we have these fellows who go around it with robes on and they shave their heads, except for a little braid in the back here, and they go around and they chant Hare Krishna. And they'll hand you a little card which says on it at the top, simply chant Hare Krishna and your life will be sublime. Well, we laugh because it sounds so ridiculous, but they're dead serious. And it's hard for us to believe that on an American campus, the United States of America, here are these people involved in this Oriental cult. And we have Buddhists. We have a girl who's a Buddhist, comes to some of our meetings, and they're real Buddhists. They're not just kidding around. They're really, you know, they're really serious about it. I went to, Rob and I taught a philosophy class the other day, and the professor's a Zen Buddhist. Interesting enough, one of the girls who I talked to afterwards came to the class because she said she's on a meditation trip. She wanted to hear this fellow on Zen Buddhism. Instead, she heard me. So she said later, maybe that was divine providence. But I was talking with Larry at lunch, and I was giving to him an illustration of a fellow I talked to in our kitchen the other day, and I was trying to explain to him that you could only know God through a personal relationship with Christ. He said, no, that was not necessary, that you could know God without a personal relationship with Christ. Well, that's nothing new to us, but the interesting thing was that this fellow thought that I was right, but he was also right. Well, it'll be obvious to most of us that we have here an antithesis, that I'm saying one thing over here, we'll call it A, and he is saying non-A. He's saying the total antithesis of what I'm saying. I have a thesis here, you can only know God through Christ. He's saying you can know God another way, And so when I say to him, well, if I'm right, you're wrong. If you're wrong, I'm right. He doesn't understand that at all. No, we're both right. Well, Larry made the statement to me that he said what he thinks is that there are elements of truth in what you're saying and elements of truth in what he's saying. No, that's not it. He's saying that the totality of my thesis, even though it's completely the opposite of the totality of his thesis, still both are right. Well, that's hard for us to grasp. How can it's completely outside of our way of thinking, and it's completely against all the rules of classical thought and speech. So what we want to get at is how we got to this today. Last summer I spent a half an hour talking to a fellow who was an atheist, not to keep him from being an atheist, just to convince him that the God I was trying to talk about was a God who had real existence, that he was not just a concept in my mind. After a half an hour, he finally understood what I meant by that, a God who had real existence, who was really there. He had not been converted from being an atheist, you see. It took a half hour just to get him to understand what I was saying, much less to change from his position of atheism. Well, I thought we'd begin by reading part of Romans 1, and then we'll start with the Greeks and which Romans 1 starts with. And as we go along, I'd like you to feel free to ask questions, particularly in regard to something I say that you may not understand. And at the end, I want to make a presentation, and then we'll just take the rest of the time for questions. From my point of view, our time will be most profitable. The more questions you have, the more profitable it will be, because we can get down to where, you know, things you're running into, make this practical to your situation and make it helpful to you. And so we'll have questions at the end, but if you have a question as we go along, something that's not clear, be sure and ask it, because it'll be no problem to stop as we go along. Beginning in Romans 1, verse 18, well, let's begin with verse 16. Paul says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek." And by the way, I think that most Christians and many of us, if we were to admit it somewhere down inside, at least intellectually, we are ashamed of the gospel. If not otherwise, at least intellectually, we have an intellectual inferiority complex when it comes to the gospel. "For in it the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith. As it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men, who by their wickedness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen." And we're, for most of us, familiar with it. Passage, so I won't read the rest of it. It describes the vileness that this position led to in the lives of these people. Well, let's begin with the Greeks, because if you've ever taken a history course in Western civilization, that's where it begins. And most professors consider the Greeks to be almost some kind of gods intellectually. And the Greeks, of course, were given to rationalism. And our definition here says, "The principle or practice of accepting reason as the only authority in determining one's opinions or course of action. In philosophy, the theory that the reason or intellect is the true source of knowledge rather than the senses." So to the Greeks, truth was in here. And it was, well, I shouldn't say it was in here, but this is the way they came to it, was by a rational process. So that the science of Aristotle, for instance, had very little to do with observation. He would merely come up with a well, perfectly balanced system. And it was, if the system was consistent with itself and perfectly balanced, he was satisfied. And a good example of this is a fellow named Zeno. How many of you ever heard of Zeno's paradoxes? Anybody? Dick? And Bruce? Well, Zeno figured out that if you had a tortoise and a hare, he put it, a turtle and a rabbit, If you had a tortoise and a hare, and the tortoise is here, and the rabbit is here, I don't know how to draw a rabbit, but we'll put him like this, that the rabbit is trying to catch the tortoise. Well, first of all, before the rabbit can catch the tortoise, he'd have to go halfway, wouldn't he? Obviously. So he goes halfway. Now, while he's going halfway, he travels much faster than the tortoise, but the tortoise will move. So let's say he goes to here. Well, again, before he gets the tortoise, he'll have to go halfway. And the tortoise moves. Well, what we have is he gets infinitely closer, but he can never catch him because every time he has to go halfway, and while he's going halfway, the tortoise moves. Well, the logic is pretty good. What can you say? He's right. The only problem is any farmer can go out and see a tortoise catch a hare any day of the week. That there's, you know, I mean, we all know that, in fact, the rabbit can catch the turtle, but intellectually, well, for Zeno, you know, he just figured that out, that tortoise couldn't catch a hare. Well, that didn't fit with observation, but that didn't seem to bother the Greeks very much. Now, I'm oversimplifying here, but basically, rationalism was the method of knowing of the Greeks. Well, down through the Middle Ages, of course, the church became influential, and with all its corruptness and problems, it influenced men's thinking. And historically, Christianity Judaism and Christianity has not been this kind of thinking, just rationalism. But the God of the Bible, the Old Testament as well as the New, is the God of Abraham and of Isaac. He's the God who opened the Red Sea. He's the God of both the cosmos, or both science and history. The reason I say science is, I just mean, who acts into the universe. He's the God of Abraham and Isaac. He's the God who opens the Red Sea. He's not just a theoretical God. We see him acting. And the method of knowing in the Judaic tradition had never been merely rationalism. Now, they were never philosophers like the Greeks were, but they demanded more than this. And again, I'm oversimplifying and abbreviating, but basically, this led to the founding of modern science, this difference. See, the Greeks never founded a modern science, and neither, of course, did the Orient. Now, the Orient didn't have this rationalism. They had a different approach, but they never produced modern science, but Western civilization did. They did produce some very good work in the area of science in terms of isolated things, in the area of mathematics and so on, but they never produced the science. Why not? Well, the men who produced modern science, we often call it the Copernican Revolution, or the Scientific Revolution, was a guy named Copernicus came up with the idea that maybe the sun didn't go around the earth, but rather the other way around. And Galileo, we're all familiar with Galileo, perhaps with Kepler. These men held a Christian point of view. Now, as far as I can tell, I don't know whether Galileo was a Christian or not, but intellectually he was a Christian. Kepler was very clearly a Christian. And from the Christian point of view, observation was important. Truth didn't just come out of your mind. See, here was a God who had acted. He was a God who had demonstrated himself. And this was the concept of their epistemology, and perhaps this is a term I should have defined, but it's just the area of philosophy in the area of knowing. How do we know things? And I don't know how many of you have asked yourselves this, but how do you know anything? Well, for the Greeks, it was just rationalism. You just resort to reason. So, this developed modern science. Galileo and Kepler came up with this, and so they coupled reason with observation. And you know, when Galileo first started looking at the stars and so on through a telescope, everybody thought he was crazy. They said, you know, you can't prove that the sun, that the earth goes around the sun, and these stars are out there just by this telescope, and they came up with all kinds of reasons that it wouldn't work. It was completely a foreign idea to them. Well, it's significant, though, that this produced a whole new way of thinking, and it's produced all of the modern technology and, you know, satellites going around the earth and rockets to the moon and toasters in our kitchen and all that's given us such a fantastic way of life materially. This has all come from science. And a few years ago, when you talk to a student about Christ, generally they had the attitude that science knows everything. Science knows. Everybody else thinks, theorizes, but science knows. And science attained this tremendous position of prominence because of what it produced. it's produced so much. And that's what's fascinated me and interested me in the method of knowing of science. Basically, it's coupling reason with observation. And we add another thing then that always results from science is it works. And this, by the way, is what I've concluded is a very simple epistemology for us. How do we know anything? We couple reason with observation. Now, we have to have both because a scientist is not just a data collector. If he just collects lots of data, he's not a scientist. He has to have a hypothesis that can explain this data. However, if he has a hypothesis and the data contradicts it, he has to throw out the hypothesis. So the two have to go together, and presumably, if we get these two to come together, our hypothesis should produce something that works. Now, Newton, for instance, came up with the idea of a satellite and how we could send a satellite up. And he was right. It just took several hundred years to get our technology to the point where we could actually do it. But theoretically, it's been possible since Isaac Newton. So this was modern science. Well, another way of putting this would be that we concluded that there was a uniformity of natural cause. And this was another idea that was a Christian idea that was basic to modern science. And what we're saying here is that the universe is basically like a machine. It has cause and effect in it. And this is why the Orient never produced a science. See, in the Orient, what is the universe? Well, the universe and God are one. So you never know what the universe is going to do you? It can be capricious. It has a will of its own. So you can't really tell what it's going to do next. And let me illustrate what I believe is the biblical concept here, that God is what in philosophy they would say transcendent. You've all probably heard that Thomas Jefferson, some of the early founders of the United States, were deists. What this means is that they believe in a transcendent God, a God who sometimes he's called the clockmaker God. He made the universe like a clock, wound it up, set it running, and forgot about it. He's a transcendent God. On the other hand, in the Orient, they believe in an immanent God. The universe and God are one. God's in the tree, God's in the dog, God's in the rocks, God's in everything. This is called pantheism. This is a transcendent idea. This is a pantheistic idea. But Christianity beautifully rejects both of these ideas and yet in a way weds them, saying that God is outside of the universe and he's created it separate from himself, that the universe and God are not one. He's created the universe separate from himself, but he does act into it. Not like the deist says, who says God can't act into the universe. He does act into it and performs what we call miracles. In other words, he sets it running like a machine, doesn't he? So when you and I see a tree fall out here, and someone says, what caused the tree to fall? What would the Oriental say? God. Simple, you know. Right, God caused the tree to fall. You know, it's all. But we would say, well, the wind may have caused it to fall. Somebody may have chopped it down. We would see a natural cause to that, wouldn't we? Well, it doesn't mean we're less spiritual, but we are less mystical. And, of course, this is the interesting thing on the campus today. Sometimes I can hardly believe in the last 3 or 4 years, this fantastic shift to mysticism. I don't know how many of you have run into it. But you don't talk about science as being, if you can show that it's scientific, that doesn't prove it to people anymore. They've shifted to mysticism. Well, the Oriental sees the tree fall, and he says, God, we say there's a natural cause. Now, the reason we believe that is because, and the reason these men here, Galileo and Kepler and the others, who founded modern science believed it, is because the Bible says that God is the same yesterday, tomorrow, and forever. With him, there is no shadow of turning. Therefore, if we drink a glass of water today and it nourishes us, it will not poison us tomorrow, the same glass of water. It will nourish us tomorrow and the next day, because the universe is a machine. It's not capricious. Do you see what we're saying here? Any questions on this point? So this, you see how this is basic to modern science, because if you think the universe is capricious, you can't go into a laboratory and experiment. You could repeat an experiment. Everything you do could be exactly the same as the way you did it the day before, and you get a different result. Because God is in the universe, and he may change his mind. So we believe the universe is a machine. Well, what happened was that men began to consider this idea of natural cause, and they became completely enamored with modern science. It made such a change in men's thinking. And they added something to this uniformity of natural cause. They added in a closed system. And you've all heard of the higher criticism in Germany where they...
Who added this now?
Well, this was just a general trend in thought about probably, let's say, the 17th, 18th centuries, the Age of Enlightenment, you know, and men begin to reject this idea of a supernatural and myth and the Bible and miracle. In other words, what we're saying, the system was closed. In other words, God cannot act into the system. This would, of course, be the deist concept. God can't act in the system. Yes, God created it, but he does not act into it. And as soon as you've said that, you've eliminated miracle. And for years, this has been the big problem between the fundamentalist or the Christian and the world, hasn't it? Or, and the liberal. They say no miracle. Let's demythologize the Bible. And so, mostly in Germany, of course, and this is one reason I'm sure that Bob senses the need to understand these men, because Germany's produced so many of them. They came up with these ideas of higher criticism and demythologizing the Bible. Now, of course, the key to this demythologizing thing is that they have a basic presupposition, and it's this: the uniformity of natural cause in a closed system. If you believe in this presupposition, there is no evidence which can possibly convince you that a miracle has ever occurred. Anything you see that is a miracle, you will explain it in some other way, and any other explanation will be more plausible because this is your basic presupposition. Dave?
Haven't they then, in that combination of reason and observation, lopped off the second half of it and just gone on reason? They observe something and they reject it because reason doesn't back it up?
Well, yeah, but basically, we all start with presuppositions, and it's that's true. That's true, yeah. They're not putting observation together in that they've seen a miracle, but it's the way you explain it. See, if you come to it saying miracles are impossible, and by the way, C.S. Lewis has a terrific little book just called Miracles, a little paperback on this, where he really brings this out clearly, that people who hold this presupposition will never be convinced of miracles because they have a presupposition they can't occur. Dick, did you? So this developed. Now, at the same time that this was happening, let's just sort of stop in time here and back up. If you've ever taken a course in the history of philosophy, it can be the most discouraging, depressing thing in the world. It can be terrible, because what you do is you study a philosophical system, and the idea in classical philosophy is you draw a circle, so to speak, which includes everything in life. It explains life. And you integrate everything, and you come up with a system which integrates everything. It gives an explanation. So in the history of philosophy, you study the system, let's say, that Plato and then Aristotle and they came up with, or that each of them came up with. And then the next one will, after you kind of see that, and you're a young student in college, and you say, boy, that looks terrific. You know, and you see this happen. I'm sure some of you have seen it with your students. Hey, that is really great, boy. And I'm going to be an Aristotelian. And then the next thing you do, the next week you go in and you study the next guy's system, and he shoots Aristotle full of holes and comes up with a new system. And so it goes. And about every 100 years, somebody comes up with a new system which takes the field of philosophy. Well, after you know, about 2,000 years or more of this in Western thought, people begin to tire of it. And of course, we're operating on this thing of rationalism, trying to do this, because all the while, man rejects revelation, doesn't he? He says, I don't want God to tell me what integrates life. I'm going to come up with it, rationalism, from my own reason. So we draw circles, and we try and include everything, and we always find a hole in it somewhere. Plus, we find that it doesn't give any meaning or any purpose to life, and one after another, after another, after another, until Western man, and here we're talking about the race, you might say, not any particular individual, because nobody's lived through those hundreds of years, but as you look over history, you begin to tire of this. And Dr. Schaefer, whom you've all heard mentioned and are familiar with who he is, I think, he uses an illustration of this, which I think is quite good. He says, this is like a man who is in a circular room, and all the lights are out, and there's no exit in the room, as he feels his way around the room trying to find an exit, he goes around and around and around this circle. And he feels his way and feels his way and feels his way. What eventually is going to happen? He'll keep getting back where he started, and he'll keep going around until eventually he'll realize there's no exit, won't he? Sartre has written Sartre has written a play called No Exit, yeah. And this is what he's getting at. He will realize there's no exit, and what will be his response to that?
Despair.
He'll despair. There is no exit. And so, this brings us to this illustration that I've drawn on this little handout for you. which Schaefer calls the line of despair, which he says that approximately 1890 in Europe and later in the U.S. about 1935, and of course dates like this are always approximate. We can pick a certain event which is perhaps crucial because these things are gradual, but about this time, men finally begin to come to the place where they despaired of ever finding an answer to life through this rationalism. Now, all the while, of course, the revelation of God is available to them, but they've rejected that. We don't want to hear an answer from God. We want to figure it out ourselves. So, and they finally despaired of ever finding this answer. And what they did was they began to reject the rational. And I've drawn this this line of despair in steps because this is the way it occurred. First, in philosophy. First, philosophers began to realize this. It's sort of philosophy who's been all the while trying to find the answer, so it would be kind of obvious that they would be the ones who would first realize it. Then in art, then music and the general culture, and finally, last of all, theology. And for instance, in art, Van Gogh and Gauguin and Cezanne and these men begin no longer to paint what they actually saw out here. Or let's say, let me put it another way. They begin no longer to paint what was actually there, but they begin to paint what they saw. And what they were doing was turning from the rational, from looking to the world out here, which is without, and turning and looking inward and painting what the mind saw. And what they were doing was turning to the existential, to the experiential. And now let me see if I can tie these two things together. We've rejected God's acting into the universe, so we have no tie with revelation of any kind. And we're beginning to reject reason, which has been the thing that was related to this idea of a transcendent God and reason. Then we find ourselves moving just imperceptibly at first almost, but we'll see as we go along, we're moving toward pantheism. We're moving toward an existential way of thinking, an experiential way of thinking. Rather than there being any truth out here, any absolute truth, we're moving toward a complete relativism. Now, also at this time, well, I've got Kierkegaard here in this illustration. And the reason he's here is because he came up with this concept of a leap of faith. And basically what Kierkegaard proposed is that because, well, let's see, I'll try and give the background of what I think brought Kierkegaard to this position. That is, briefly, that this thing of the uniformity of natural causes in a closed system ruled out the supernatural. So in the area of theology, the liberal movement developed. And what the liberal movement was demythologizing the Bible. And of course, as soon as you take all the miracle and supernatural out of the Bible, all you have left are the ethics and the morals. So the liberal movement became a social movement. Your Christianity becomes social action. And Christianity was polarized between liberal and fundamental groups. And liberalism, probably, I suppose we could say for 50 years, was the prevalent religious kind of thinking. And but eventually it wore out because people found there was no message to it. A man would stand up in the pulpit and say, we ought to act this way, but why should we act this way? And what power do you have to act that way? So he had no more to say than a philosopher. And so one pastor said that his new theology was born between the study and the pulpit. That in his study, he was a liberal. The reason he was a liberal was because he did not believe in the supernatural. Basic presupposition. Science, this is an age of science. We believe in scientific thought and rational thought, and we don't believe in the supernatural. But on the way to the pulpit, he realized he had no message for his people. And he became a neo-Orthodox. And what these men did was they had to go back to orthodoxy for the message that orthodoxy had. But, and we're going to get to Kierkegaard in a minute as really being perhaps the forerunner of this whole thing, they couldn't really embrace orthodoxy because of their presupposition, the uniformity of natural cause in a closed system. Because Christian orthodoxy purports that God can act into the system. So what they did was they tried to get the message of orthodoxy without really having orthodoxy. It was a new orthodoxy. So they went back to the miracles of the Bible, the resurrection of Christ, for instance. They want the message of the resurrection of Christ without really having the resurrection. So if you take Kierkegaard, he said, well, here in the... Well, let's just... You can look at this. This is sort of complicated to look at because I put an awful lot on it. But let's just take the first line of this illustration. Here, with reason, in my reason, Kierkegaard says to himself, I see that miracles are impossible. Christ could not have been raised from the dead. Why? Because God does not act into the system. So that's impossible. In my reason. But I see that in believing that, life has no meaning. Christianity has no meaning. There's no purpose to it. So I've got to have the meaning of the resurrection, even though I can't believe it. So I make a leap of faith. Against everything I know to be true, I believe it anyway. This is what's meant by a leap of faith. I hope that after today no one will ever use this term, a leap of faith, in terms of becoming a Christian. Because he was saying, opposed to everything I know, I will believe. And the Bible never asks us for that kind of faith. It always asks us, on the basis of everything you know, not knowing everything, but on the basis of what you do know, you take a step of faith. So just for my own terminology, I like to distinguish between a leap of faith and a step of faith. Because the Bible asks for a step. Larry?
You say he takes a leap of faith, he believes that, but he doesn't really believe it.
Well, see, yes, he does. But the problem is, Larry, that you and I, it's hard... What your question, you say he believes it, but he doesn't really believe it. Your question merely illustrates the very difficulty of us understanding this way of thinking. What had happened here was that people had begun to... I'm trying to think of the man's name. Dottie, maybe you can help me. Before Kant, who came up with this idea of antithesis, and Hegel. That Hegel had come up with this idea, which is, of course, foundational to communism and dialectical materialism, of antithesis, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Well, his idea was that we don't have truth out of thesis and antithesis, but we have truth out of a synthesis of these. And so that neither this is, it's not this is true and this is false, but they're both true and we get a synthesis. And we get a new thesis from that. So basically, Hegel is very hard to understand and very hard to explain, but basically what he's saying is that there is no absolute truth. He's completely rejecting the idea of absolute truth. Well, so what Kierkegaard has done here is said, so in terms of truth, well, let's just look at this handout. Reason, all rationality and logic, including all scientific evidence and data and history. In terms of that, we can only have what we get under the line. The next thing over here is pessimism. All rationality brings it to pessimism. This is what Sartre, of course, says, life is absurd. It's nothing but a pessimistic thing. Dick?
Well, I'm interested in the word faith up there. What if you say that's agreeable with the dictionary definition that you've got here?
Well, the reason I put this down is because I think this dictionary definition is part right and part wrong. I think that the definition they've given here is very much like Kierkegaard's idea. The first two, the first and second definitions that they give are unquestioning belief and unquestioning belief in God, religion, etc. And that is kind of the leap of faith.
Unquestioning, and that doesn't require evidence or something like that.
Right. You just believe it. Why do you believe it? Well, because all you have below the line here is pessimism. You have to believe something. So you make a leap. You make a leap of faith into this upper story, which is the non-rational and non-logical. There's no contact with science or history. And to have any optimism, according to the existentialist, you've got to be non-rational. Because if you use your reason, you'll see that there's no hope, that man is lost in an absurd world, and his life is meaningless. Now, the thing that makes this difficult is there are so many strands of things that have brought this about is where to bring them in. And one of them, obviously, has been Darwinian thought, evolutionary thought, which has brought man to the idea that he is merely a chance collocution of atoms with time and chance thrown in, and here we are. Well, when you take that point of view, there can be no meaning to man's life. He's merely a product of his environment and heredity. And by meaning, for instance, there would be, if that is true, there would be no meaning to our discussion here today. Everything I would say merely because I'm programmed that way. Everything you ask or say would be merely because you're programmed that way. So there's no meaning to it. We're just going through motion just like a machine. Just like an IBM machine, you plug in the card and it does the things it's supposed to do. So you're programmed. I say something, it's perfectly programmed what comes back. So there's no meaning to your life. You're just like a machine. You see what I mean? So this is why kids today are so searching for meaning. Because the philosophy of our time has brought them to the point of thinking there is no meaning. And in fact, their parents really didn't have any basis for meaning. When I say this, I'm not speaking in terms of specific individuals, but in a general way. But they believed it anyway. They grew up in a Christian background, and so even though they came to reject Christianity, they still lived on the basis of it. They lived as if there were absolutes, even though they didn't believe there were. Now, they didn't live really morally, but they still acted as if there were absolutes. And they can't understand why their kids are off, you know, a lot of middle-class people, why their kids are off in hippies, and they've rejected the complete value system. But the thing is, the kids are really carrying to the logical conclusion, the thought forms of their parents in many cases. But and even with some of these theologians like Tillich and Bultmann and Brunner and these men, they continued to live on the basis of the Christian background they'd been brought up in. And some of them have been quite shocked at what some of their students have done, like the death of God. Well, these men, like Alistair, they don't believe that God has died. They don't believe he was ever alive. What they mean is the death of the concept of God. We have no longer have a need for the concept of God. So, see if I haven't gotten too far astray here. I don't want to be confusing, but Kierkegaard came up with this idea of a leap of faith, and what that did was it freed man from the rational. You no longer have to think in terms of the rational. If you think you wish you could believe this, then you just believe it. If you say, as for instance, here's what this man who, on the way to from his study to his pulpit, he's thinking, I wish I could believe in the resurrection of Christ, because that would give me a message for these people. But I can't believe it because miracles are impossible. So what do? You just believe it anyway. And as Larry says, you don't really believe it, not in the sense that we talk about believe, not in the sense that we talk about having content to your belief, but you believe it in the sense of acting on it. You go ahead and commit yourself to it.
Is that what you're saying these parents were doing in the past generation?
If you have a non-Christian philosophy or worldview, it is impossible to live with that. It's impossible for anyone to live consistently with a non-Christian worldview. The reason is because God's created the universe and he's revealed to us a system of thought, answers, explanation to that universe, which is consistent with the universe he's created. And if we hold any other system but that, it's going to be inconsistent with the universe as we find it. Therefore, because we have to live with the universe as we find it, we're going to have to live inconsistently with our system of thought. Does that sound like a riddle, or does that make sense? Do you follow me on that?
I think so. In other words, parents take this this line that because of the things that they observe, there must be a God. They don't have any real basis. All right?
What they do, let me just take an example. Let's say that a middle-class parent says to his hippie son, how can you do this to me? Why are you on drugs? Don't you realize what this is doing? The answer of the child would probably be, why shouldn't I be on drugs? And whatever answer the parent gives, if the parent does not believe in an absolute God, what absolute does he have? Why shouldn't the kid be on drugs? If he wants to be on drugs, it's as good as anything else, isn't it? See, if you're going to have a moral system, it has to have some absolute that you finally get back to, doesn't it? Any kind of law or moral system, you've got to eventually get down to some kind of bedrock. Well, I have never heard anyone propose any bedrock you can really come to except an absolute in the universe, which has got to be God. They may say, well, there's just that absolute, but they're making that God, actually. Sometimes they say love these days, but then, you know, what's love? And why love? Why not something else? Really, in other words, really, unless God exists, there is no basis for any ethical system or any moral system at all. If I hit you in the face, you have no reason to say it's wrong. I mean, why would it be wrong? You say, well, because you're hurting me. Well, so who's to say I shouldn't hurt you? Now, see, Nietzsche, who is the philosopher upon whose thought much of Nazism was based, Nietzsche said that might makes right. If I'm bigger than you, then I can hit you if I want. And this is what the Marquis de Sade, this was his philosophy. And this is where the term sadism comes from. If a man wants to beat a woman, he can. If he's stronger than her, what's right in the universe is, you know, what's stronger. So what he's saying is, what is, is. And which is what the existentialist says, in a sense. What is, that's all we can say. Of course, as Dr. Schaefer points out, the real question is, why is there anything? Where did it come from if there's no God? And really, it's so exciting to me to realize that the truth of the Scripture, when Psalm 14:1 says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Because I have become absolutely, completely convinced that no man, no one, can say in his mind, there is no God. It is impossible to believe that, intellectually. That's why the psalmist says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that does good. This gives me a tremendous... One of the things that studying some of these things has done for me is given me a tremendous confidence and excitement to go onto the campus and just delight to talk with anybody, whether he's the PhD or the most formidable enemy of Christianity on the campus, because I know that I have a completely unfair advantage in our discussion, and that is that Christianity is true. It is absolutely true. It doesn't just work, it's true. And as I approach some of these things myself, one of my problems as I look back is that, and let me say this for us and the Navigators, oftentimes when people say, well, how do I know this? We resort to a purely pragmatic approach. It works. And if we get this kind of thinking in people's minds, if they ever become theologically oriented, they'll become neo-Orthodox. Now, many of us who may think in those terms are not neo-Orthodox because we don't think in terms of theology. We are inconsistent in our own thinking. But if we're just interested in what works, that's a basis for becoming new Orthodox. As I look back, I had some personal questions, and it seems to me that I had two alternatives. Without getting those questions answered, if I were intellectually honest and stuck with a classical concept of truth and antithesis, I would have to just sort of reject Christianity unless I got those questions answered. Or I could just say, well, I'll just believe it anyway, and I'd become new Orthodox. So Kierkegaard said, make a leap of faith. And as I have in the diagram, out of this came secular existentialism and religious existentialism. Finally, this gets down to theology. And neo-orthodoxy is nothing more than existentialism and theology. Tom?
Before we get too far off this, you said you go onto the campus knowing it's true. And how does that differ between the fact that you say, I know it works? I don't quite understand that.
Well, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And it seems to me he was saying three things there in those three words. When he said, I'm the way, he was saying it works. It's the way to God. Perhaps that was for the religious man. The truth, C.S. Lewis became a Christian because it was the truth. He was compelled to. Same way that Dr. Schaefer did. And so some people, they see it's true. And a lot of our kids in Boulder are excited about this. Many of them have said that they became Christians. Well, the reason I became a Christian is I finally saw it was true. It was it gave the answers. And the life, well, I think that's probably why I became a Christian originally, because I was just in high school and I wanted abundant life, and I saw that Jesus offered it. But some people are oriented to truth. And let's say an engineering type person, they are more oriented to what works. I noticed I was over in the engineering center on campus one day, and there's quite a large one at Boulder, and I was waiting to meet someone. As I watched people walking around, I thought, you know, this is so different than being over in the arts and sciences school. I thought it's kind of attractive in a way. People seem to know where they're going. You know, they look like they've got purpose, and they're going around working on projects and slide rules and computers, you know. Well, it's attractive in a way, but in another way it's not attractive. Now, I'm going to make a generalization here, which isn't always true, it's just a generalization, but what they're doing is they're concerned on how do you build that bridge, or that bomb, or that whatever it is. How it's used? They're not thinking too much about that. How do you build it? How do you do it? Does it work? Over in the arts and science school, you know, they're roaring around, what are we doing with the bomb, and why are we doing it, and why is this, and why does it work, and completely different mentality. So, you know, not everybody thinks the same, but it gives me confidence because on a college campus, supposedly, we're in the pursuit of truth. And it gives me confidence because when I talk to someone, I no longer feel like, well, Christianity works for me, but if Buddhism works for you, well, what can I say? In fact, you know, what can you say? If the only reason you believe Christianity is because it works, and you talk to a Mormon and he says, well, boy, this has changed my life, there's nothing more you can say, really. Mormonism works for you. Christianity works for me. Buddhism works for you. Those guys out in Hare Krishna, they think that works for them. Now, we know that in time it won't. In fact, I would venture to say that any of you here would say you know that that will not last. Why? Well, if you really do, only because you believe Christianity is true. And we must stick with this classical concept of truth. Jerry?
I was going to ask you to elaborate more on if this changes your approach in that knowing is true. I mean, you're trying to express this evidently to the person you're talking to. How do you express this?
Well, the number one change it makes in my approach, and I've noticed like in our training program last summer, in the approach of some of the kids in the training program, is it gives me tremendous confidence. Tremendous confidence. Larry? Well, I think that all three of these things are important. Threefold epistemology that I put up here. It's got to check with observation. Lauren has often said he believes the Bible because he finds that it explains life so well. Well, in other words, that's observation. To take to scientific method. Now, when I say the scientific method, I don't mean test tubes or rocks that you chip hammers you chip rocks with or telescopes. The scientific method is a way of knowing, and those are just different tools that you use to get the data. But I mean taking a hypothesis, putting it together with the data, and then experimenting with it. And so I think we need all three of these things. Anything we believe, basically, we should be able to somehow fit that test to it. Why do I believe this? Well, because it makes sense. See, if it's internally contradictory, then we've got a problem. Now, let me say, sometimes things may appear to be internally contradictory. For instance, in science, there are things we don't know, like in electricity, which way it flows, positive, negative, negative, positive. In some experiments, we get one, some the other, and so on. So we don't know everything, but if it's clearly internally contradictory, in other words, people sometimes say the Bible contradicts itself. Well, if the Christian system really did contradict itself, we'd have to reject it. You know, you can't say A is both true and false. Now, sometimes we say, well, someone asks us, is that true? And we say, well, yes and no. And what we mean is that what you were saying earlier, some aspects are true. In some ways it's true, but in other ways it's not. But we can't say that this in its totality is both true and false at the same time. The reason we can't is that you can't think that way, you can't talk that way. Dr. Schaefer, in one of these books, he says something that I thought was really excellent in regard to that. He's talking about the rejection of antithesis. Yeah, he says, second, they all believed in the rational. He's talking about classical philosophy. This word has no relationship to the word rationalism. They acted upon the basis that man's aspiration for the validity of reason was well-founded. They thought in terms of antithesis. He's talking about classical philosophers. If a certain thing was true, the opposite was not true. In morals, if a thing was right, the opposite was wrong. This is something that goes as far back as you can go in man's thinking. There is no historic basis for the later Heidegger's position that the pre-Socratic Greeks prior to Aristotle thought differently. As a matter of fact, and here's what I think is so good, it is the only way man can think. The sobering fact is that the only way one can reject thinking in terms of antithesis, and the rational is on the basis of the rational and the antithesis. When a man says that thinking in terms of an antithesis is wrong, what he is really doing is using the concept of antithesis to deny antithesis. That is the way God has made us, and there is no other way to think. Do you see that? It's so beautiful. I said to this kid in my kitchen that I was referring to a little while ago, finally, near the end of our conversation, I said something, and he said, "No, that's wrong." And I said, "You're finally beginning to understand. I mean, you're coming." I was making progress. Now, you see, a few years ago, we didn't have to begin back there, and this would relate to what you asked me, Jerry, and my approach. We knew when we talked to somebody, if I said, "I'm wrong," or "You're wrong, I'm right," that they, you know, they understood that. Or, again, Dr. Shaver used the illustration, if you said to a girl, "Be a good girl," she knew what you meant. She might not do it, but she knew what you were talking about. You know, a good girl. What does that mean today, be a good girl? What's good? What's bad? The thing is, we've rejected our basis. And so when I talk to a guy now, sometimes I have to go back further. In other words, I just have to, instead of, let's say, you know, I'm trying to proceed in this direction to get him to come to a decision for Christ, instead of starting here, I have to start clear back here. Now, the reason I can start here before is because of this Christian heritage that we have. People understood the idea. Everyone accepted the idea of antithesis. Everyone accepted when we talked about God, they knew what we meant. Whether they believed in him or not, they knew that we were talking about a God who had real existence. Right? Now, this wasn't true in Japan. If you go to Japan, and as a friend of mine with Campus Crusade said, he'd said, "God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life," and they said, "Which God?" See, so he had to back up, didn't he? Go back earlier than where he talked to an American and explain which God he meant. Same thing with the Greeks. Not this God of war or this God of love or these gods that are anthropomorphic that you've created to be just like you, but the God of the universe, who is the personal, infinite God. So this is one of the things in my approach, Jerry. Often I think I just have to back up. Now, I don't think I have to intellectualize, necessarily. In a way, what you're doing, you just have to speak their language. And if you're talking one language and they're talking the other, it'd be just like my going over to Germany and trying to witness in English. And I'm talking to them about God. And there, when I say all words are is symbols, and I'm talking to them with this three-letter word that's a symbol, and what I say it to in meaning, it comes out meaning one thing, but it goes into their brain meaning something else. Well, there's no communication, complete breakdown of communication.
How would this on approach? Often, when someone doesn't believe the Bible, they say, "How do you know this is true?" I respond by giving a testimony, telling them how my life changed. It worked. In other words, that's what I'm saying. Are you saying that there's something, you need to do something else besides this?
Well, not if that satisfies him at the point. Let me say, I don't try to dump the whole load on everybody just because the degree of what a man needs to know depends partly on his orientation of mind and partly on how desperate he is.
Well, I think about people that have this.
Yeah, because if you give your testimony to what Dr. Shaver calls a 20th century man, a man who really thinks this way, and the only people who don't are middle class people. There's still a section of the middle class that has not come around to this, and the reason in the Navigators we've gotten away this long without relating to this anymore is because basically we work with the middle class. You know, the kids we work with are middle class kids. But I've noticed that our European staff, boy, when we talk to them, they are hot to learn about this because they've been running this for a long time. But here in America, it's been not so long. But so if you're talking to a real 20th century man, a man who thinks in this way of synthesis and relativism and so on, then when you give your testimony, that will carry some weight, but his response will probably be, "Well, that's great for you. I'm glad it's helped you." Daddy?
In a way, that's just confirming his existentialism, though, because that's your existential experience, apart from the
right. Truth. Right. Dick?
Well, I've just got a question based on this confidence. For instance, on not so much Christianity, but the belief in the Bible. So you haven't heard what Billy Graham saying on after he looked at the whole situation, there were some things that he just couldn't reconcile or he couldn't understand, so he just took it by faith. Now, not really having necessarily evidence for it, other than his own belief that what God had said is true. My question is, isn't that a leap of faith?
Well, I've heard Billy Graham say this, And sometimes it bothers me to hear him say it, because there's, though I can identify with it, there's also a problem with it. And it's hard to disagree with Billy Graham, of course. But in a way, he is making a little leap, maybe. But let me say that if a person believes something, if they believe the right thing, even though it may be for the wrong reasons, it'll work. But we do not... Here's what I think is right about what Billy is saying. And that is that... let's say here's what we... Well, let's... Okay, let's just let this line illustrate all of knowledge in a given area that we want to believe something about. Well, you know, usually we have about that much. Well, if Billy was feeling at the time that he wanted to know all of this to know whether he should believe, we'll never know all of it. In any area, not just Christianity or the Bible or theology, in anything. It's just like electricity is always a good example. We know very little about it, but we know enough to know that if we flip the switch, the lights will come on. And so we act on that.
Interesting on this point, just this last trip to Germany, Billy Graham sent Dr. Bob Firm over to meet with a lot of the theologians and answer a lot of their questions. And after one of the sessions, I was talking to Dr. Firm, and on this point, he said, well, of course, Billy uses this, you know, I just accept it by faith. He said, I reached the same conclusion, but I'm a historian. I studied it, the records and all this, and I reached the same conclusion. The Bible is the Word of God from history. This is where I reached it, not just by a leap of faith. In the same conclusion,
but through
a different route.
Yeah. I think that, let's take, if you have a lake out here with ice on it, and two people are considering walking on that lake, one may, you know, dig a hole and examine the thickness of the ice and figure out the tensile strength and the whole works, you know, the slide rule and everything. And then, on the basis of the facts that he has, he doesn't know everything about it, but he's got enough to be convinced that that ice will hold him. He walks out on the lake. The ice holds him. The other guy is a dumb botch. He doesn't know anything. You know, he just thinks, oh, that looks cool. I think I'll go out there. And he goes out. The ice holds him too. He didn't have good reason to go out there. He may have even believed it. He may have even had one of these little I Ching books like some of our kids have on campus now, another little Oriental religion going around, and they open up I Ching and they read something and they throw down some deals, and depending on the pattern they come out, they look up something in the back, and you know, and that tells them to go to something else, and then they read it, and if you read it, you can conclude about anything you want to from it. It's so vague. And they conclude from that the ice will hold them. Well, the fact that they had a completely wrong reason for believing the ice will hold them will not keep it from holding them, will it? The only thing that is key here is that we must be believing in a gospel that has content. See, here's the way Billy's faith is not a leap. He believes that Christ did, in fact, live and die, and if you'd been there, you could get a splinter in your hand from the cross. It was there. And he was resurrected, and Thomas could put his hands in the holes in his side and his wrists and so on, you see. And he believes that it does have historical fact to it. I think really what Billy's saying is that maybe Bob Firm has this much knowledge and Billy only has that much, because Bob Firm is a scholar and Billy's not a scholar. But the fact is that he has enough knowledge to be convinced. I see that it's time for coffee break. Should we take a break?